is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 62, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. And every Thursday, I release an episode called Paranormal Stories, and that is UFO cases, as well as information on evidence of an afterlife. And if you want to hear the extended version of this episode, which is an extra 25 minutes, you'll need to join the Patreon campaign. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. And this week I'm talking to Daniel Coombe about his book, Anomaly, A Scientific Exploration of the UFO Phenomena. Daniel received a PhD in theoretical particle physics from the University of Glasgow. He has held research positions at Syracuse University in New York, Jagiellonian University in Poland, and the prestigious Niels Bohr Institute in Denmark. Daniel has published 14 peer-reviewed research papers on theoretical physics, including articles in world-leading journals such as A Physical Review Letters and Classical and Quantum Gravity. Daniel Coombe is the author of a graduate-level textbook on quantum gravity called Magnifying Space-Time, How Physics Changes with Scale. He has taught college-level courses in physics and mathematics and has given numerous presentations at international physics conferences. Hi, Daniel. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thanks very much, Simon. It's great to be here.
You've got a book that's fascinating. It's called Anomaly, A Scientific Exploration of the UFO Phenomenon. First of all, why is the book called Anomaly?
It's called Anomaly because I wanted to make it, you know, like a technical scientific sounding term. Because I wanted this to be a kind of serious book. So probably a lot of your listeners and myself included have read a lot of books on the subject of UAPs / UFOs. And typically, it's not always the case, but typically these type of books, they deal with anecdotal evidence, right? So I wanted to try to take a more scientific approach. And so I wanted the title to reflect that. So I guess I could just give a bit of background about myself, which might help answer that question. I have a PhD in theoretical particle physics obtained from the University of Glasgow in the UK. And then I had three postdocs, so 6 years in total, one in New York in the US, then one in Poland in Krakow. And then lastly, in Copenhagen at the Niels Bohr Institute. I have quite a heavy science background, I guess. And so I wanted to use that skill set as the idea to try to investigate this UAP phenomenon and try to contribute something to the field, whatever that is. And so that kind of explains why I called it Anomaly, I think.
So, in scientific terms, what does anomaly mean?
All right, great question. So an anomaly is this is technical jargon, but it's a statistically significant difference between a theoretical model and an actual observation. So a real world experiment or some actual observation. Okay, so it's that tension between what somebody predicts from a model and what they actually observe in reality. So perhaps I could give an example of that. It's so if you look at the history of physics, right? So I have this physics background, so that helps me. So Isaac Newton, his law of gravitation, it held dominance for way over 200 years, right? In certain parts of the world, he was even seen as some sort of demigod. His ideas were so influential. And so his laws predicted very precisely the planetary orbits of all of our planets in the solar system. And, you know, so you could predict exactly where Mars would be at a given time. So everything worked very nicely, except for the planet Mercury. So that was a bit of an anomaly. It will come to pass. So the planet Mercury, its orbit misbehaved, let's say. Slightly. The technical details don't matter, but its orbit behaved in a weird way. And so this was known for a long time, even when Newton was still alive. But people could not fathom the idea that Newton could be wrong, right? His ideas were so influential, they didn't want to question his ideas. But as more and more data were collected on Mercury and its orbit, and as more and more time went by, people realized, okay, there is actually something real here. So there was some initial observation, and then you have to carefully reproduce that anomaly, and then you become more and more sure that it's a real data point. Okay. And then eventually, when you have collected enough evidence for this anomaly, then that actual single observation can become powerful enough to overthrow the whole of Newtonian mechanics, which was dominant for so long. And so that would be an example of an anomaly. But then you've got to replace that theory eventually. So Newton's ideas about gravitation eventually needed replacing. And it was Albert Einstein that actually came along and replaced that idea with his general theory of relativity, which I've studied for quite a few years. So this feeds into the whole concept surrounding Thomas Kuhn and his excellent book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, where he discussed this idea of there's some anomaly, and then eventually you have a revolution in science when that anomaly becomes so powerful it can no longer be ignored.
So I was going to ask about anomalies being ignored. Somebody said to me once on a podcast, scientists will sweep anomalies under the carpet till the furniture topples over. Do you think that's fair?
I think there are two. I've read that there are two types of scientists. Okay, there's the conservative one, and then there's the more radical type. Okay, so in the history of physics, it's typically the radicals, the kind of free thinking people that aren't as constrained, that make real progress in physics. For example, Niels Bohr, when he was coming up or originating quantum mechanics, his mind just worked in a certain way where he wasn't dogmatically forced into thinking along the conventional lines of physics. He could just switch his mind and be like, okay, we need a new theory. We've got to overthrow the old theory. And he could do that very easily. Okay. But, there are some scientists that just find that very hard. There's a lot of inertia in physics and science in general, whereby scientists just sort of dogmatically stick to the known paradigm, and you see that all the time. But we need those radical thinkers. We need a mixture, right? Science normally progresses along quite nicely with these conventional thinkers, but just occasionally you need like that 1%, 2% of radical thinkers, and they don't ignore anomalies, right? They don't sweep it under the rug. And I think that's what a good scientist should do. They should not run away from an anomalous result. They should ask more and more about that result and try to find out its nature. Is it statistically significant? Does it go away with increased data or not? And then eventually, if it passes all those tests, they need to ask themselves, do we need a new model? Like, do we need a paradigm shift in our understanding? I think that's what a good scientist should do.
So what made you start looking at UFOs? Was there one particular thing that jumped out at you?
Given my scientific background, quite a lot of people are surprised that I started looking at this. And I could trace it back to around December 2017, when this New York Times article came out by one of your previous guests. Ralph Blumenthal, he co-wrote it, and then the testimony of Commander David Fravor to do with the Nimitz encounter. I remember seeing that I don't remember where it was, it's somewhere online, maybe a news article, and he just seemed really kind of sincere in his eyewitness testimony, his account of what happened, and that was combined with was it Alex Dietrich? She was also up there in the air with him. So there were four eyewitnesses of this Nimitz encounter, two in each aircraft, right? And they also had different perspectives, which is important to do with eyewitness accountability. And Yeah, it was just the way he delivered that. I just kind of believed him, actually. He just seemed very sincere. And then I thought about his pedigree as well. You know, this is a Top Gun graduate. He's trained pilots. He keeps our airspace safe, a very reliable character. But being a scientist, I then had to kind of doubt that testimony, right? Because that's okay to get you intrigued in the subject, but it's not enough like hard evidence as a scientist. So then I kind of switched roles. I tried to ignore all eyewitness testimony as far as possible. Of course, it factors in, but I rated that as not the highest evidence level. So I started looking at the actual raw data. Okay, so there are some cases which have radar readings of UAPs in the sky, and also FLIR camera footage, like infrared thermal image video of UAPs. And I just found that much more convincing from a scientific background because, you know, sensors don't lie. They don't get tired or they don't have a bad day. And so I just felt it much more reliable. And so I tried to reflect this in my book. So I came up with a scoring system whereby the analogy is it's like filtering evidence. So you have a first filter, and that is eyewitness testimony. Okay, so I rated the eyewitnesses based on, you know, whether they're a trained pilot or a police officer or something where they've had training in observation, like in the Nimitz encounter. David Fravor was clearly a trained pilot. He knew what was common in the skies and what was not. Okay, so I gave them some score based on that. That was the first filter. Then, if they passed through that filter, then they would get to the second one, which was to do with single sensor data. So here, this would be, for example, an individual radar reading of a UAP, or it could be some FLIR camera footage. But crucially, it's just a single observation by a sensor. Okay. That was filter two, and I gave that a bigger weighting because I consider it more important than just eyewitness testimony alone. Then the third filter was multiple sensor data. So here, in the Japan Airlines case, which I include in the book, for example, there are three independent radar readings, and they all observed some UAP in the skies over Alaska. And so that is much more strong evidence, right? Because it's incredibly unlikely that all three radars would malfunction simultaneously. Of course, it could happen to one radar, but for three of them to do it simultaneously, I think that's very unlikely. And so that's a really strong piece of evidence. Then the last filter, the piece of evidence I consider the strongest is physical evidence. Okay, so there are a number of cases in UAP history where people have actually recovered metallic debris, for example. So in the book, I discuss the Ubatuba case, which happened in Brazil in the 50s. And in that case, the witness, I can go into more detail later, but the witness saw an exploding UAP over the sea near the coast of São Paulo in Brazil. And then some metallic debris rained down onto the beach. And he took a sample of this, and it's now been tested by many very prestigious universities in the world. Yeah, and it does have some really strange characteristics, this metal. So I count that as the strongest piece of evidence because you can subdivide this metallic debris, right? You could cut little slivers off and send it to independent research groups all around the world. And they can test that and they can do it any number of times they want. So they can do repeatability experiments, and that's an important part of science. So yeah, I had this filter system to try to weigh the evidence in each case.
If we could talk about the Brazilian fragments,
Sure.
first of all, the tests showed it was nearly 100% magnesium. And why would that be weird?
Why is that weird? Well, First of all, it's not quite, as you say, it's nearly 100%. It was actually 99.94%, I have written here, pure magnesium. That is strange because the date of this incident, so it was near São Paulo in 1957, to be exact. Okay, so in 1957, they didn't have many methods of manufacturing such pure magnesium. During the research for the book, I found there were a few. One, I believe, was located in Australia in some chemical lab, and one in England. But there were only like two or three, maybe a handful of locations across the entire globe at that time that could produce such pure magnesium. It's very hard to get 99.94% magnesium. So that was strange in itself, although that doesn't, of course, let us believe that it's an alien spacecraft or something like this. It's strange given where it was found, like, i.e., on a beach in Brazil, and when it was found, i.e., in 1957. It's just a strange observation.
And there was some strontium in it, wasn't there? That's a bit strange as well.
That's right. So strontium impurities were found. So it wasn't like there were massive blobs of strontium within this magnesium sample. They were sort of, and I've heard it described by the chemists that study it, it almost looks like they were put in at the atomic level. So they were just like very small regions which had strontium impurities added to the magnesium. And this could not be easily explained. The US Air Force investigated this sample. And particularly a chemist called Dr. Craig, I believe he also worked on Project Blue Book. He analyzed this magnesium and they were just baffled as to why there was strontium put into this, because no magnesium was manufactured using strontium. There was just no reason, or there was no known reason at that time for adding strontium to a magnesium sample. So it was very puzzling. And the chemists in the Project Blue Book report, they comment that it seemed to have been deliberately added, right? It wasn't just some accident of manufacture. It's been put in there almost at the atomic level deliberately. And then I started thinking about why might they do that. So I had to research for many months about that, and I read a lot of chemistry papers, which is not my background, but I did so. And it's possible that it's because magnesium, right, is a very light element. So probably all of you at school have played around with magnesium, burning it, and it burns like a very combustible white color, very bright color. But it's very light, so that is advantageous for aircraft design. Obviously, you're an aircraft to fly, you want to not produce, well, you want to not have much fuel burn to make it fly. So it's the power to weight ratio. Okay, so magnesium would be ideal for an aircraft because it's very light, it can fly very easily, but there are downsides to using magnesium for aircraft. Namely, they have a very low yield strength, meaning it's not very hard. The material is not very hard. And of course, you want that for an aircraft, right? You don't want it just to fall out of the sky because it can't withstand the G forces and so on. And also, we all know magnesium combusts very easily, like these science experiments where you burn it. Okay, and so in the course of my research, I found out that adding strontium impurities, it actually radically makes the magnesium harder, much harder. So you still retain the excellent properties for aircraft flight, like it's very lightweight and so on, but it makes it very strong by adding this impurity. It also makes it less combustible. So it looks like somebody knew what they were doing and they added these strontium impurities on almost an atomic level for design reasons.
And when, sorry, go on.
Okay, sorry. I was just going to then go on to discuss the isotopes. Is that okay with you?
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about that.
Oh, okay, great. So, then I looked at the isotopic ratios of magnesium. So first, I don't know if everybody's familiar with what an isotope is, but it's essentially like you have an element and it has the same number of protons, right? But you can add or subtract a neutron from that element. So for example, with magnesium, you have magnesium 24, but then you also have an isotope. It's like a kind of cousin of magnesium, magnesium 26, and you also have magnesium 25. There are three kind of flavors or varieties of magnesium. These are the isotopes, okay? And what I found is that, or other researchers found this, and I just analyzed their data, but I found that the magnesium 26 to magnesium 24 ratio is way off the chart, actually. It doesn't appear at normal terrestrial levels. So when the solar system was formed, for example, there are certain ratios of isotopes that are fixed in place. And the ratio that I observed, magnesium 26 to 24, is 2.1 standard deviations greater than the terrestrial level. So it's in conflict with it being made in our solar system. But, you know, being a skeptical scientist, I must caution against this. So, okay, this is only a 2 sigma tension, which means it's roughly a 2% chance that this could just be a statistical fluke. Okay, but that's fairly strong. I mean, in the social sciences, they count a discovery when you have 2 sigma or more. So this would actually count as a discovery in social sciences, but in my background of particle physics, we're much stricter. And so we only declare a discovery at around 5 sigma. So there's a much higher standard of evidence in particle physics. Yeah, but it's very interesting why this ratio is way off of the value we would expect. Actually, very bizarre. Yeah, so that's the Ubertuber case.
And also, it's interesting, I think, didn't the witness say that when the UFO exploded, it was really bright light, like you'd expect from magnesium?
Yeah, exactly right. So just to describe what the witness saw a bit more, he said there was a craft, a metallic-looking craft, and he was on the beach, and then this craft came in, and it was diving down like it was in some sort of trouble, diving down towards the water in the coast. And then just before it hit the water, it then kind of looked like it rebounded off the water and shot straight up into the air. Quite a significant altitude of maybe around 1 kilometer, and then it exploded. And it kind of rained debris down on the beach. And as you say, it was a very bright white color. I think he even describes it as casting shadows at one point. So it was a very bright explosion.
If we could look at the Japanese Airlines flight, because that's got tons of radar data, hasn't it? As well as people who saw it. What happened? He was flying over Alaska and then he saw some lights to his right?
Yeah. So there was this Captain Teruchi, he was called. So this Japan Airlines pilot. So just to give you some context, I'll back up. So it was Japan Airlines Flight 1628 and it occurred on November 17, 1986. So there was this Captain Teruchi, his co-pilot, and a flight engineer. Now, they were the only ones on board the plane because it was a cargo flight. Okay, so there were no passengers, and that's quite important because it limits the number of witnesses. But, they were flying from Paris, heading towards Tokyo in Japan. And on a certain segment of their flight over Alaska, they encountered some really bizarre things. So the captain claims he saw a series of lights off in the distance at the beginning and slightly below their altitude. And then he contacted the radar at Anchorage in Alaska, asking them if they have any traffic. Traffic meaning, you know, is there any risk of a collision, in-flight collision? And the ground control at Anchorage confirmed, and this is in the official documents, they confirmed that there was a radar hit, and it was approximately 5 miles behind the Japan Airlines flight. And then the Japan Airlines flight quickly get back and say, no, it's not behind us, it's now in front of us. And so there's this back and forward in the transcript you can read, where the Japan Airlines captain, Captain Taruchi, is saying that these lights seem to be moving almost in a circular motion around around the aircraft. Okay, then a little bit later, NORAD, the military facility, so NORAD, you know, tracks the potential nuclear missiles. It's very important for the air defense of Canada and the US. But then NORAD also picked up this UAP or whatever it was. So they got some primary surge. So a primary radar return is where the radar energy sent up from the radar hits the object, the aircraft, whatever it is, and actually reflects off the surface of the aircraft and bounces back. Okay. So there was definitely something up there, something physical that it was reflecting off. And that was also confirmed by NORAD. And then the air traffic control at Anchorage, they asked NORAD to keep an eye on this UAP or whatever it was, and also to confirm that there are no other military aircraft in the area. And that's a really important thing to do because you want to try to eliminate that, right? It could be the test of some unknown aircraft. But NORAD actually confirmed in the transcript that there is no military aircraft up there. And what's weirder is that it could not have been a commercial aircraft either, because the transponder, so there's a little device on each aircraft, each airplane, that is interrogated by a radar signal. And then it says, okay, I'm going to emit my location and my special code that will identify the flight number. Okay, so for example, like a United Airlines flight, it will have a transponder that says, okay, I am this United Airlines flight. It tells the radar system on the ground. But the UAP did not have a transponder code. So that's very bizarre. And legally, you have to have a transponder code if you're a commercial flight. So it seems that we can rule out military aircraft, at least according to NORAD, and we can rule out commercial flights. But the case gets bizarre, even more bizarre, because later on, the captain then sees a kind of, he describes it as a giant silhouette of an aircraft behind him. So I believe they were approaching Anchorage at this time, and there were a lot of city lights behind them, and that created a silhouette of some unknown object. But the captain drew this object that he saw in the official documents, and it's massive. So he describes it as 1 to 2 times the size of an aircraft carrier, which is really, really big. Just to give some context, an aircraft carrier is around 300 meters across. So we're talking bigger than 300 meters, which is massive. But he did not actually see the craft per se itself. He said he saw the silhouette only, just the outline.
That must have been pretty scary.
Yeah, right. He did get very intimidated by this. And also, air traffic control were getting a bit scared at this point. And so they offered military intervention, actually. So they offered the military to scramble and intercept this UAP. And also, they suggested that the captain make a series of maneuvers to try to evade this massive thing that was chasing them, whatever that was. So they, for example, did a 40-degree right turn. Then they did a drop in altitude, a pretty significant drop. And then finally did a 360-degree rotation to try to shake off this object. But according to the captain and the flight engineer, it still followed them. It didn't disappear immediately. And then the radar returns were still there even at this point, and I was able to obtain the actual radar data from an online resource, the Black Vault. I obtained it from there. These are the official radar returns, and being a mathematical scientist, I was able to import these, I think it was 180 pages of radar data. It was pretty significant. I was able to import that into a program, Mathematica, and then use some trigonometry and, some calculation. And then I was able to actually reproduce the flight path of not only Japan Airlines flight, but also the UAP that interacted with it. So that was pretty interesting.
I was going to ask you about these 11 jumps that you see on the radar, where they traveled, what is it, approximately 70 nautical miles in a matter of seconds, with immense G-forces and acceleration.
Yeah, exactly. It's really remarkable. I mean, when I was making this data, I had no idea what I would actually see. And it was quite shocking when I actually plotted it and I could see for the first time these huge jumps it makes. Okay, and just to give your listeners some context, as you say, each of these jumps is around 70 nautical miles, but it occurs within 12 seconds. So each radar sweep, the radar at anchorage, it could sweep the entire airspace every 12 seconds. Okay. So we don't know what happened in between the jumps, but we know the beginning point and the end point of the jump. What happened in between is a mystery. But if you make certain physics assumptions, like it started from stationary position and then it ended at stationary position, which is supported by the radar data. And then you use some Newtonian physics, the details don't matter so much. But you can actually use that physics to work out the acceleration of each of these 11 jumps. And you can do that. And you get a result that's pretty startling. So three of the 11 were over 9,400 Gs. So just for some context again, a G-force is the acceleration you experience just standing on the surface of the Earth, right? That's just your weight pushing down due to gravity accelerating it. But here, this UAP experienced 9,400 Gs on three separate occasions. So this would be enough to, if the occupant of the UAP was a human, for example, they would essentially be a bloody mess on the wall. You could not survive this. It would just liquidate you because the acceleration is way too vast. So using this data, I was actually able to rule out or eliminate a manned aircraft. Of course, it still could be something like a drone, but even that becomes hard because the aircraft that we have, or at least that we know about in our inventory, the structural integrity of those aircrafts cannot withstand 10,000 G either. They would just simply break apart and they cannot withstand those G forces. So it's very mysterious what I found. But just to also say that even jet pilots, they become unconscious even at around 10 G. So that's orders of magnitude lower than the highest accelerations I found. In fact, the world record was held by an IndyCar driver. So luckily for him, or maybe unluckily, depending on your perspective, he crashed his IndyCar. And the accelerometer on board that car registered 214 Gs, but he survived, luckily. But he did have all sorts of horrible problems like broken bones and so on. But that is actually the world record, just 214 Gs. And here we're talking about 10,000 Gs, way, way bigger than a human could possibly survive.
Is it the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry published, did a press release saying the mystery's been solved? And what their explanation for what happened was just madness.
Yeah, I don't put much weight to that explanation because I, of course, looked into it. I mean, that's a really important part of investigating this case. But I was able to put in to a star tracker. So, online you have these various star trackers where you can look up what the night sky would look like on a certain date and time. And so I did that when the Japan Airlines case was occurring. And there's significant disagreement between the position of Jupiter and Mars at that time. So I worked out the disagreement between where the pilot said the UAP was and where Jupiter was. It was around 60 degrees. So it was way off. And especially given that this pilot, Captain Terucci, he had over 10,000 hours of flight experience. And he was a veteran from some conflict. I don't remember which conflict, but he had a lot of flight experience. And for him to mistake Jupiter or Mars for a giant aircraft twice the size of an aircraft carrier, that would be really surprising.
And also, Jupiter and Mars don't turn up on radar very often.
Yes, good point. So, as I mentioned earlier, there were three radar readings, and they all triangulated this UAP. So it's very, very unlikely that it was a malfunction, and there was clearly some physical object up there. And as you say, yeah, it could not have been Mars or Jupiter. They don't reflect radar reading. That's right.
And Captain Terucci was grounded, wasn't he? He lost his job as a pilot?
Yeah, that's right. And there are all sorts of conspiracies around this. But the official story that I read on the Black Bolt is that Captain Terucci was talking too much, essentially. He was talking to the press about his experience, because understandably, he was very excited, and this was a huge thing. You know, it changed his worldview, like a paradigm shift, like I mentioned earlier. And so he was very excited, and he was talking a lot to the press, and they, whoever that is, the powers that be, decided to ground him and stick him behind a desk for most of the rest of his career. I heard it, eventually he did fly again, but it was towards the end of his career. So that was very sad, just for reporting what he saw.
And something else that's interesting about this is the radar returns and showing that immense speed and the G-forces. And that was also reported recently, wasn't it, with the USS Princeton that showed the UFOs dropped, was it 28,000 feet in less than a second?
That's right, yeah. So just to add to my analysis of the Japan Airlines case, not only were there three accelerations that were really, really high, around 10,000 G, there were also three maximum speeds that were very high. So three of the jumps, they had a maximum speed of over 300 max. So one Mach is the speed of sound. So this UAP went 300 times the speed of sound on three different occasions. And yet no sonic boom was ever reported by the captain or the co-pilot or the flight engineer. So that is extremely puzzling. And yeah, as you mentioned, the Nimitz encounter, I believe it was Kevin Day, right? The chief radar officer on board the Princeton. Kevin Day, he reported that the UAP was observed at around 28,000 feet, as you say, on radar. And then it dropped to just 50 feet above the surface of the ocean within 0.78 seconds. So that, again, is an incredible acceleration. And my colleague, Professor Knuth at the State University of New York at Albany, he has done an excellent publication on this, on UAP. And he used those numbers there that I just said to estimate the acceleration. And I believe he got around 5,000 Gs. So about half of what I found, but still astronomically high. So that just supports the fact that it seems on multiple different occasions, these craft are doing things that we just cannot do with our aircraft, or, and especially it could not be piloted by a human or really anything biological above about 2 or 3 kilograms, because you would just be a liquid mess on the wall.
So can we now talk about another case study, the Aguadilla object?
That's a good one. So I mentioned earlier that I had this scoring system in my book, and this Aguadilla object, they actually scored the highest. So that means it, in my view, in my analysis, it had the greatest amount of evidence for something anomalous. So yeah. On April 25, 2013, so quite a recent one, In Puerto Rico, this occurred. There was a ground-based radar, and it picked up some weird object, and the object was behaving, had a flight path that was very strange. It was doing sort of zigzag motions about 3 miles northwest of the Rafael Hernandez Airport. Apologies if I'm not pronouncing that correct, in Puerto Rico. So I was able to obtain the radar data in this case as well, and reproduce that in a graph. And you can find that in the book, but it's a very strange sort of, it almost looks like a search pattern. So above the ocean in a certain location, it's kind of dotting around or ping-ponging around. And it looks like it's looking for something or searching for something in the ocean. But, you know, we need to be careful. That's my interpretation of it. But think what you will. Okay, so that was off the coast. And also the radar that detected this object, it again had no transponder code. So remember I said there's some device on each aircraft that should emit a code that identifies it. But this object did not have one either, which again is illegal if it's a commercial aircraft. So that was very strange. And the movement of this craft was just very erratic. It's not what you would expect from an air balloon, for example, because a hot air balloon would just follow the current of the wind, right? It can't really maneuver itself. And we've heard a lot about this recently with the Chinese spy balloon and so on. But yeah, it could not control its own motion, but this object appeared to do so. So that was weird. And also, again, in the Japan Airlines case, there were these 11 jumps. But in this case, with the Aguadilla object, there were just 2 jumps that were slightly strange. And they both of these 2 jumps, they had a speed greater than the speed of sound. So over Mach 1 in this case. They're not as big as with the Japan Airlines case, but still pretty fast. And again, no sonic boom was heard. So this appears to be a reoccurring theme that these craft or objects, whatever they are, they appear to be able to maneuver really fast, faster than the speed of sound, but with absolutely no sonic boom, which is really bizarre to me as a physicist. And I've researched this a lot, and apparently there is a US company that produces a technology, so they have some airplane that can reduce a sonic boom, okay? But it cannot stop it altogether. So there still should have been some boom emitted, even if it was this really advanced technology from the US. But that is very puzzling. Then, with the Aguadilla object, after this radar reading, there's even more evidence. So a few minutes later, it was then picked up independently by a thermal imaging camera on board a US Customs and Border Protection aircraft. And it was tracked for several minutes on this this thermal imaging camera. And you can see this video online. I believe it's on YouTube, but also the original video is hosted on the Black Vault. So I recommend you look that up. It's very interesting. And using the latitude and longitude coordinates of this object, which are printed on the video, you can see them in the bottom right-hand corner of the video, you can use that data to actually locate where this object was, and then you can track its position across the Earth, across Puerto Rico. And I did that, and I was able to use that information to also work out this object's speed. Okay, and its speed was around 90 miles per hour at this point when it was in the thermal imaging video, which is nothing too crazy, but it is above wind speed. So again, that kind of makes the idea of an air balloon unlikely. But the really weird thing is that it was at 90 miles per hour in the air. Then it went over the coast and entered the water, and it still stayed at 90 miles per hour. And that's very bizarre because you have drag force, right? If any object enters the water or tries to enter the water, it will either skim off of the surface of the water, like skimming a stone across a pond, or if it does enter the water, it will be significantly slowed. because water is much denser than air. And so the drag force is huge in water. And so, yeah, this object did not appear to even recognize that water was there. It just entered the water and continued on as if nothing had happened. And this 90 miles per hour, it actually breaks the world record for underwater travel. So we have various submarines that obviously travel under the water, but not even those can travel at this speed. So that's quite remarkable in itself. Yeah, and then even more. So after entering the water, it then eventually exited the Atlantic Ocean, and it appeared to divide or split into two separate objects, each with a separate heat signature. And this is just really weird. We don't have many aircraft that can just divide into two different things, right? Very bizarre feature. And I've heard it argued by various skeptics and so on that this could have been something impacting the water and then just breaking apart. But that doesn't seem consistent with the data, because these two objects, they actually exhibit controlled movement after they've divided. And so if it was just an explosion wreckage, you would think they would just sort of rain down and then fall into the sea. But they actually appear to exhibit controlled movement after this. So very strange.
Well, I was going to move on to this information that was released by the Pentagon recently with these different videos. And I did interview a guy called Matthew Roberts, and he was the intelligence officer on the USS Roosevelt when it all happened. And so the videos went straight to him when they came in. And I did say to him, you can answer this question just yes or no. Did a lot of other stuff happen that you can't talk about? And he just says, yes. But part of the intelligence report said that they had 144 cases and 143 of them they could not explain.
Yeah, that's right. So this is the ODNI report, right? Yeah. So they had, I heard it was now 142 they still couldn't explain, because apparently one quite recently was also explained. So the when they first released the report, they said there was one of the 144 that could not be, or that could be explained, I beg your pardon. And that was a deflated balloon, if I remember correctly. But now apparently they've identified a second one, but still that leaves 142 cases unidentified. And that is a bit disturbing, given that this is the supposedly most powerful military and navy in the entire world. And yet there are 142 objects just in this one report itself that could fly with impunity in their airspace, and they had no idea what these things are. That's a bit worrying to me. Yeah, and then you have pilots like Ryan Graves, right? He's done a number of podcasts. I think he does the Merged podcast now. And he was a pilot on the East Coast, and they've said similar things. So they, Ryan has said that they had encounters almost every day, or every day, in fact, you know, over a period of almost a year. So that's hundreds of these encounters. So it just seems really unlikely that this is some prosaic explanation of, like, you know, airborne clutter or a balloon, because they're encountering these things every day, and they appear to show up on radar and be observed in a consistent manner. So they do this, I've heard it described as a racetrack pattern, a kind of squashed oval pattern, and they can maintain flight for way longer than any aircraft we know of, in a stationary position as well sometimes. So even against the wind, they can just hover there for many, many, many hours, whereas some of the US aircraft would have to go back and refuel on the aircraft carrier within just hours, actually. So it's not all adding up, really, to me. But this report is a good first beginning, I think. And then we had the other report released recently, and that was just really lacking in detail, I felt. It was a bit frustrating.
And there was a point, was it the Tic Tacs that they kind of disappeared, and then the aircraft got on with their maneuvers, their military stuff, and they went to a rendezvous point and the UAPs were waiting for them.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's in the limits encounter. So I didn't study that in my book because in the limits encounter, although I don't doubt his testimony, but it is nevertheless just eyewitness testimony, even though it is eyewitness of a radar reading. So this Kevin Day, this chief officer, he says that he observed the radar and it took 0.78 seconds for it to drop, you know, 28,000 feet and so on. But because I don't actually have that data, I couldn't actually get my hands on it and analyze it. So I chose not to analyze that in the book. But yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was a very interesting encounter, the Nimitz.
And it seems that the US government's taking it more seriously because if a possibility that it might be a threat, I suppose they've always, if anything enters your airspace, you don't know what it is, you consider it to be a threat before you've identified it.
Yeah, I think that's their default position. But I wonder whether this idea of considering it a national threat could be, and I'm speculating here, but this could be a tactic in some way. So I've heard that within the US government, there are kind of two different camps. One camp wants disclosure or to tell the public what they know, at least. And the other camp, which seems to be led by the US Air Force, is much more resistant to that. So I wonder, could this be a tactic within the powers that be? So they might be, for example, putting it in the guise of it's a security threat, a national security threat, because that will make politicians stand up and listen. They will start thinking, okay, there is actually a military threat here. We need to actually investigate this. Whereas if you put it in the guise of something more generic, like, oh, there's an unidentified flying object in our airspace, it's just a bit more wishy-washy. And so they cannot do as much with that. So yeah, that's my suspicion, that I think they're using this as a political tactic to try to get it heard or to get it out into the public.
And what about this thing you talk about? It was Captain Robert Salas who talked about the Malmstrom Air Force Base nuclear weapons being shut down by a UFO, but he's not the only guy that's reported this. Do you pay much attention to it because it's just anecdotal?
I did pay attention to it because of the quality of the eyewitness as well. So this, what was he called? Salas, right? Colonel or Captain Salas.
Yeah.
And yeah, and I've seen him interviewed and he also seems very sincere. He has this strong military background, makes a good eyewitness. I don't see any incentive for him to just make this up. And so this event occurred in 1967 in Montana. So in Montana, they have a whole bunch of nuclear facilities under the ground because it's in a good location to launch a strategic strike, a counterattack. And so he was based way underground, like 60 feet, I think, below the surface of Montana. In this concrete shell, essentially. They encase it in thick concrete to protect it. And yeah, he says that he had reports of strange lights in the sky from above on the surface. And then minutes later, apparently 10 of the missiles simultaneously shut down. And this is a really worrying thing because these missiles, you know, if, you know, and I'm not pointing fingers, but say Russia, for example, were to launch a nuclear strike, then this base might have to counterattack and launch from there. But for a number of minutes, these 10 missiles were completely impotent. They could not launch them even if they wanted to. And yeah, and so there was an official investigation into this, apparently, whereby they concluded, and this was the US government that investigated it, and they concluded that for all 10 missiles to shut down simultaneously was, in their words, extremely remote, the chances. Because, crucially, these 10 missiles were independent of each other. Okay, so it's not like there was a cable connecting them underground or something. They were independent facilities. And they were made that way because, and it makes sense, because if one gets knocked out, then you still have 9 left, right, to fire back. So there's logic there. And so they were completely independent. And so for a malfunction to occur in all 10 simultaneously, the chances of that are essentially zero.
And the book we've been talking about is called Anomaly, a scientific exploration of the UFO phenomenon, and that's on Amazon, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah, you can get that on Amazon.com. Yeah, you can also go to my personal webpage, which is Daniel Coom at googlesites.com. And on there, you can find a discount for the book.
Well, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast. It's been fascinating.
Thank you very much, Simon. It's been great.
And that was an interview with Daniel Coom about his book, Anomaly, A Scientific Exploration of the UFO Phenomenon. If you want to hear the rest of this fascinating interview, you'll need to sign up to Patreon for the extended episode, which is about an extra 25 minutes. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. If you join the $4.50 a month tier, you'll get access to an extended episode every month. If you join the $7.50 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week. And when you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And there's now over 60 extended episodes there. And please check out my other podcast. It's called The Past Lives Podcast. There are over 250 episodes. On The Past Lives Podcast, I look into evidence of an afterlife, such as near-death experiences, children with past life memories, mediumship, deathbed visions, and other phenomena. I also release an extra episode of The Past Lives Podcast every Thursday called Paranormal Stories. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. And the link's in the show notes. My Instagram is Past Lives Podcast with an underscore between each word. And in my work as a clinical hypnotherapist, I take people through past life regression. And when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me and you've signed up to Patreon, you get a 25% discount. And I'm offering a free consultation call, which can be booked on my website. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. Did you take a look at the possibility that these UAPs are human technology?
I did. I considered it, especially towards the end of the book. It just seems that given these really large accelerations that I calculated and that are supported by independent...